Tonight on the Daily Debrief.
Did you actually totally exonerate the president?
No.
Special counsel Robert Mueller testifies about Russian campaign interference. Plus,
after hiding the body and cleaning up the scene, Nicole Notman continues to set this trap for her mother.
A Florida college student says beatings and schizophrenia caused her to kill her mother and stepfather. And did this European webcam woman drive a defendant to murder his whole family? Plus, accident or murder? Friends say they never saw injuries on a child whose foster parents are accused of homicidal abuse. The Daily Debrief recaps the day in court. It's Wednesday, July 24th. Welcome to The Debrief, everybody. Glad you're with us, along with Linda Kenny Bodden and Brian Buckmeyer. Special Counsel Robert Mueller testifying today before two House committees about his report into Russian interference with the 2016 presidential election. The first hearing was before the House Judiciary Committee, the second before the House Intelligence Committee. Chief Investigative Correspondent Brian Ross has key moments for us tonight from the newsroom.
Well, good afternoon, Aaron. Mueller testified for more than 5.5 hours today, answering questions that were sometimes terse and often stumbling. But he made several key points. First, that President Trump's claims that he had been exonerated by the Mueller report was not true.
So the report did not conclude that he did not commit obstruction of justice. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And what about total exoneration? Did you actually totally exonerate the president?
No.
Now, in fact, your report expressly states that it does not exonerate the president.
It does.
And Mueller dodged questions about the Justice Department policy that does not permit the indictment of a sitting president. But he said it was his view that the policy would allow the indictment of the president after he left office.
Could you charge the president with a crime after he left office?
Yes.
You believe that he committed, you could charge the president of the United States with obstruction of justice after he left office?
Yes.
And Mueller pushed back hard on Mr. Trump's claims that the investigation was a witch hunt or a hoax.
And when Donald Trump called your investigation a witch hunt, that was also false, was it not?
I'd like to think so, yes.
Well, your investigation is not a witch hunt, is it?
It is not a witch hunt.
When the president said the Russian interference was a hoax, that was false, wasn't it?
True.
When he said it publicly, it was false?
He did say publicly that it was false, yes.
And when he told it to Putin?
And Mueller showed his most animation when a Republican congressman attacked his office staff as being too political and made up of agents and prosecutors who were Democrats who supported Hillary Clinton.
We strove to hire those individuals that could do the job. I've been in this business for almost 25 years, and in those 25 years, I have not had occasion once to ask somebody about their political affiliation. It is not done. What I care about is the capability of the individual to do the job and do the job quickly and seriously and with integrity.
Again and again, Aaron, Democrats pushed Mr. Mueller to talk about the possibility of impeachment. He wouldn't even say the word for them, Aaron.
Brian Ross, of course, we hear the word integrity coming out of Mueller's lips there, but again, Republicans pushing back here and saying, how can you have an investigation with integrity if it's staffed by people with potential or perceived conflicts?
That's right. That was one of the strongest Republican attacks. The other was, why aren't you investigating the investigators? Did this thing start with Russian sort of false information fed to through the dossier, supposedly, that implicated Trump?
A lot of legal questions still hanging in the air tonight. Brian Ross from the newsroom, thanks. A new trial we're following tonight where a Florida woman says voices in her head led her to kill her mother and her stepfather. Nicole Notman is raising an insanity defense involving schizophrenia. She's also raising battered child syndrome as a self-defense, saying she was beaten and finally snapped back. Notman confessed that she drove home from Florida State University, shot Robert Deans, set a trap for her mother, Miriam, using an email the mother sent to the father.
She discovers that Miriam Lear, who's in Jacksonville, is trying to reach Robert through email on his Yahoo account. And she's telling him, I'm trying to reach you. I'm trying to call you. What's going on? Why aren't you responding? And Nicole Notman captured that email on her phone. And you're going to hear how she tried to access that Yahoo account, how she tried to change the password on Robert's Yahoo account, all while he's laying dead in an adjoining room. You see, ladies and gentlemen, for this trap to work, the mom could not know she was home. In order to kill her mom, she needed to surprise her mom. She needed Robert out of the way so he couldn't protect her, and she needed her mom to be completely unsuspecting.
That's the state side of things. The defense began its opening statement late in the day. We'll bring that to you on tomorrow's debrief. Day two in the trial of a Florida man accused of killing his family after he stole their money and sent it to a webcam girlfriend in Bulgaria. 29-year-old Grant Amato is accused of taking $200,000 from his mother, Margaret, his father, Chad, and his brother, Cody. Prosecutors say the father gave the defendant a list of rules such as get a job, stop spending every night online, and go get therapy. Rather than comply, the defendant is accused of murdering them and then trying to take money from their life insurance policies. This is the woman state of Florida investigators say was the defendant's obsession. Were his ties to this Romanian webcam woman so strong that he pulled the trigger and killed his mother, his father, and his brother? The first witness in this case was a friend who worked with victim Cody Amato and who called the police when Cody did not come to work.
So I tried to call the phone, and it went, rang a couple times and went straight to voicemail. So then we have a friend that we went to school with. He now lives in New York. I kind of text him, and I said, hey, have you heard from Cody, like, overnight at all? He said, no, why? I said, he's not here at work. He said, well, did you try to call him? I said, yeah, of course I tried to call him. And then I had talked to a couple other colleagues about him not showing up, and everybody's response was, I can't believe he's not here. This is so out of ordinary. Why would he not show up? Even if he didn't show up, he always had his phone on him. He should have answered, called back, something.
So at some point did your concerns rise to the level where you thought, now I better
We got to do something because my friend's not here and he's supposed to be here. So we bounced around the idea of, like, what we should do if somebody should try to go to his house or whatever, or if somebody should try to call a wellness check. And I called in and I got some, maybe a dispatcher or somebody, and I had said, hey, my friend's not at work. I'd just like to call in an official wellness check to see where he's at. They had asked me a couple things about him, and I expressed my concern, and they said, well, we'll send somebody over to the house.
Next to testify was a responding police officer.
Tell the juries just generally where the bodies were located.
So the first one that we came to was in a kitchen area. The second one was in what I'll describe to be sort of a storage / workout room off of the garage. And the last one was in what I'll describe to be a sort of set up as an office area, home office area with a desk.
Now, initially, did you believe the body that was found in the kitchen area to be that of Grant Amato?
That was one theory. We didn't know for sure, but that was one theory, yes.
But at some point later on, did you discover that, in fact, it was not Grant Amato's body, but it was Chad Amato?
That's correct.
A crime scene analyst testified that there were no signs of forced entry.
Starting with the outside of the home, did you make any observations of the home?
I observed all the windows and doors to be secured, with the exception of the one that was opened by responding deputies. I observed the garage door to be opened, and I observed two vehicles in the garage, as well as a third vehicle under a canopy that was southwest of the garage.
Did you notice any damage to any of the exterior windows?
No, none of the windows appeared to have any damage to them.
Any pry marks?
No pry marks were observed on any of the windows.
Did all the windows appear to be closed?
That is correct.
Another strange piece of this puzzle was the presence of some drugs at the scene.
I located prescription medicine as well as marijuana. There was a unmarked prescription bottle that had suspected marijuana in it in Margaret's vehicle. There were three mason jars in on top of the firearm locker, so to speak, in Chad's closet that contains suspected marijuana, in the master bathroom, in one of the bathroom drawers, there were two small chocolate mint containers that had suspected marijuana in them.
The substances you found, what conclusions were you able to make?
That they were for personal use.
Was there anywhere in the home that you suspected cannabis was previously or was being grown or previously grown?
Yes, there was. In the master bathroom, there was a wooden closet that had been originally up against the doors that the deputies had made entry, and that had been actually pushed by the deputies in order to get into the master bathroom. Inside this closet were items that were consistent with growing marijuana. It did not appear to be actively growing marijuana at that time.
And criminal defense attorneys Brian Buckmeyer and Linda Kenny Bodden are with us tonight here on The Debrief. So, Brian, what's going on here? This defendant's accused of moving the bodies and staging the scene to make it look like his brother was the real killer. And that's a pretty harsh accusation for the police to make to try to make sense of a scene. What's your thought on it?
Yeah, so they're putting all their cards into one deck and saying that we can basically prove that not only was this some sort of execution style murder, but also that there's this impetus as to this cam girl and him going crazy for her, and also trying to put the blame on his brother. If they get it all together, great, but if the defense is able to pick out one of those dominoes, it can all collapse on itself.
Exactly, and we see the defendant crying there in court when he was shown the pictures of his dead family members up on the monitor there from body cams and whatnot. But let me ask you, Linda, about these drugs that were found in the house. What does that tell us? Does that mean something in relation to what actually happened there? Why is that evidence in evidence in this case?
Yeah, well, I think the defense is going to try to say, well, there may be more people that had a motive to kill this group of the family members, right? You have somebody who was growing marijuana, obviously probably selling marijuana, it appears, and therefore maybe this was a drug deal gone bad.
You know, but Brian, we listened to the state ask questions of that witness, and the state's questions were, no, this did not look like a drug house. This was personal consumption. I don't think this had anything to do with selling, so they tried to deflate that potential tactic right off the bat. Did it work?
I'm not sure, because I don't know how in depth they're going with whether or not this is a grow house. This could be that they were actively selling, that they were once selling. This could be a rival saying, hey, we're shutting this down and killing everyone to send a message. I think the defense still has something to play with.
Maybe a little bit. The question is, will it actually get traction with the jury? We'll be back to the panel at the end of the broadcast, because still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, we head back to the case of a husband and wife accused of murdering their foster child. Witnesses are saying they never saw suspicious injuries on the child who died. We're going to break that case down in just a moment. Now to the defense case and the trial of a Georgia couple whose two-year-old foster daughter died in their care. Joseph and Jennifer Rosenbaum face a mix of murder and other charges over the death of Layla Marie Daniel. Prosecutors say Layla died from abuse. The defendants say the girl died accidentally by choking on a piece of chicken and that she was further injured during CPR. The state says Layla may have been having a seizure, not choking, and that the seizure may have been triggered by abuse. The defense has elicited testimony that the girls may have been hurt elsewhere or that no one else who interacted with them saw the injuries.
Did you see any marks or bruises on these children?
No, I did not.
And if you had, what would you have done?
I would have reported it to Henry County DFACS.
How, if this party was Malik's birthday, do you recall what day it was?
Like the date or a day? I believe it was a Saturday.
Just the month?
It was in August.
August of 2015?
Yes.
How were the girls acting towards Jennifer?
Oh, fine. They were eating when I was there. They were eating cupcakes from this, you know, from the party.
Okay. And how was she acting towards them?
Fine.
Anything about their behavior that caused you any concern?
No.
This parade of witnesses continued with an acquaintance who is also a foster mother.
me, how did Jennifer react to the children and the children react to Jennifer?
You could tell they loved her. They would hold on to her. They were happy. If I wouldn't have known it, I would have never known those weren't her kids.
Did either of the daughters appear to be afraid of Jennifer?
No, ma'am, they did not.
And how did Jennifer react towards them?
She was loving and happy and just doted on those girls.
Would you be here testifying if you had seen anything that concerned you?
No, ma'am.
Okay. As a mandated reporter, what would you have done if you had seen marks or bruises on these children?
Well, if I'd seen anything on them, then I would have had to call somebody and ask about it the same I would with any child.
A lot of witnesses agreed that they did not see bruises on the victim like the ones found by authorities after her death, or on the victim's sister for that matter. This next witness fed into the defense claim that whatever injuries were present were part of normal childhood activity.
I would say the oldest sister was more laid back, relaxed. She would focus just on one toy or one item. We had a large variety of items to choose from, and so she picked one and she just sat there and played with it. The youngest sister, she was rambunctious. She moved about a lot.
How did the girls act towards Jennifer?
They just played and ignored, you know, what we talked about, and occasionally, you know, we'd look over to say something and they would respond back, but nothing in particular that I have concerns for.
Did you see anything wrong with the girls, with their face, with their body?
Layla had a bump over, I don't remember which eye it was, but I just remember that it was like I call it a goose egg, a knot. And so I was like, ooh, I said, you have a goose egg. And her sister, Millie, responded, sissy fail, you know. So I just took it as it's a childhood, you know, injury.
Did you notice any raccooning eyes, any dark circles around the eyes?
Not at that time that I remember.
Any bruises, cuts, or lacerations?
It was in the summertime, so they had on like little dresses, little, you know, onesie outfits, and I didn't see anything with the exception of, you know, like said, the goose egg.
Defendant Joseph Rosenbaum's sister testified that the victim and her sister were normal on November 11th. The victim died on November 17th, as this testimony explains.
Did you see anything on her that day that caused you any alarm?
No, ma'am.
November 17th, did you go to the hospital?
Yes, ma'am.
And tell me what you saw with regards to Jennifer and Joseph Rosenbaum.
When I got there, they were in a room. It was off to the side, and everybody was distraught, and I was trying to figure out what happened. And a detective and a coroner came in, and Jen was explaining what happened, that she had choked on a piece of chicken, and she had tried the Heimlich maneuver and tried to do a finger sweep and tried to use a butter knife as a tongue depressor to try to make sure her airway was clear. And when the coroner walked in, he was really strange. He was like, oh, that Jennifer Rosenbaum. Like, he already had knew who she was. And, I mean, she was a public figure. So I just figured they knew each other. But the way he said it was really off to me. But it was a really hard night.
Many witnesses who supported the Rosenbaums actually retracted their opinions on cross-examination like this.
Initially, you felt the girls were in good hands.
Yes, ma'am.
Have you heard the phrase, hindsight is 20/20?
Yes, ma'am.
Have you had hindsight now in regards to the Rosenbaum?
Yes, ma'am.
The statements that you wrote in regards to not feeling that the defendants were to blame, do you still stand by those statements?
No, ma'am.
And why not?
I think after the facts started coming out about the case, the questions of the bruising on them, things that we recollect that were red flags, as far as the bruising and the questions that we asked and the answers that we got back from Jennifer just kind of did not add up.
That is a big retraction. So let's bring the panel into this discussion one last time. Linda Candy Budden, you're nodding your head here, right? Because we've had, what, a half dozen, maybe even a dozen witnesses get up there and say, look, I interacted with these two defendants and the victim and her sister regularly, and I didn't see anything strange. But then the backpedaling is right. What's disturbing.
Right. Well, it's disturbing if you're a defense attorney. But you know what, Aaron? When you're looking at somebody, I'm looking at you right now. It's in the summertime. Or you're looking at me, Brian. Do you see any bruising? Yeah. But if actually you looked harder and you were looking for something, you'd find I have a huge bruise under here from my dog that jumped on me. People aren't looking for that. But then when they learn and they see, oh, my God, maybe I saw something, and then they start backpedaling.
You know, what's disturbing about it, from just a public perspective, is that something like this, Brian, could go on for so long without someone stopping it, because all of these witnesses are saying, no, I would have stopped it if I had seen it. So if these accusations are true, they did go on, and yet no one spotted it.
Well, no one's spotting it. It kind of goes with confirmation bias. That mostly applies when two people are watching sports and they're rivals. One would say that the ball is out of bounds, would say that it's in bounds. In this situation, they're looking at the children and say, yeah, there's a bump, but I believe they're good parents, so there must be a benign reason for it. When that good parent idea starts to fall apart, now they're going back like, ooh, maybe that bump wasn't what I thought it was.
Exactly. People are second-guessing themselves, and they're probably hating themselves for it. Linda, I've heard multiple explanations for this butter knife. Was right. It a tongue depressor to try to get this alleged chicken out? Was it something that the defendant was using to shove the chicken in right. And force feed the child? How many different versions of the story are we going to hear about what exactly happened?
And it really doesn't matter, because this child had a pancreas that was severed basically in two, torn apart in two. That's a real deep hit, as you know, and it didn't happen from a butter knife.
And Brian, lastly, we heard that sister say everybody in the emergency room was distraught. Everybody, because other witnesses have said the defendants were not distraught, that something was off with them.
Well, it's I very much doubt that she's focused on the parent. She's probably internalizing how she feels. She's very distraught. She's watching the child. So she's probably imprinting her feelings and her emotions at the time upon everyone else
Everybody
in the room.
Everybody else. So some of the other medical professionals said, no, it wasn't quite that way. Linda, Brian, thanks for joining us tonight. It's all the time we have for the debrief. We'll see you back here tomorrow at 5 p.m. Have a good night.